to Embracing Your Mortality podcast with me, Sue Brain. Throughout the year, on the first day of the month, I'm going to be posting an interview with someone who is dedicated to helping all of us to live more consciously for a better world. My February guest is William Peters. He's the founder of the Shared Crossing Project and author of Heaven's Door. He's also a psychotherapist specializing in grief and bereavement and has worked as a teacher and social worker in Central and South America and is recognized as a global leader in the field of shared death studies. Now, I'm particularly interested in William's work because of taking such an active role in one of the first research projects into end-of-life experiences, which was led by neuropsychiatrist Dr. Peter Fenwick. And you can listen to Peter talking about consciousness and end-of-life experiences in Season 3, Episode 9 of Embracing Your Mortality podcast. Now, welcome, William. And you seem to be taking your research a step further into what might happen during the dying process and afterwards than we did in our end-of-life experience study. But before we get into this, can you explain what the Shared Crossing Project is all about?
Yes. First, I just want to thank you, Sue, for having me here today. It's an honor. And so, yes, I will define the Shared Crossing Project's work. Really, the mission of the Shared Crossing Project is to transform people's relationship to end of life and death and dying through raising awareness and educating people about these profound and healing and mystical experiences that occur at the end of life, not just for the dying, but also for the caregiver loved ones. And we feel that all of that knowledge that is largely unappreciated and unknown in the modern world really casts a different light on what's happening at this great journey we will all take called human death.
So can you just explain what a shared death experience is or a shared death crossing is?
Yeah. So the shared death experience occurs when somebody is dying and a caregiver, loved one, sometimes just a bystander, will express that they feel that at that moment of death or around that time, they shared in or witnessed the dying person's transition from this human life into the afterlife. And they often call it a beautiful or a glorious afterlife. Those are adjectives they use. So there's a way in which the shared death experiencer is having a lens into the experience that the dying person is having. And sometimes that looks like they accompany the dying across the threshold and they'll see a lot of phenomena that are similar to the near-death experience. So that would be, they may see deceased loved ones appear to greet them. They may see a life review of the dying, and that life review may be just the dying's life review, but it may also include the shared death experiencer. If they're a loved one, they may see their life together. There's often elevated beings, as we call them, kind of light beings or higher consciousness beings that seem to be there serving as guides. There's one in particular that I'm interested in. I call it the conductor. It seems like there's this force that appears in a variety of forms, but it's clearly more conscious, powerful. It has a kind of an ominous but loving presence that seems to have the mandate of transitioning soul spirits from the human realm into the afterlife. And so there are other characteristics, heavenly realms, a border at which the shared death experiencer cannot pass. The light is very profound. It seems like what we hear in our research is that the experiencer says that that we were ascending, or the dying was ascending towards the light, and that felt like the bridge into another dimension. So those are some of the features. But if you understand the near-death experience, then you'll understand the shared death experience in terms of what they're seeing. The most important characteristic, which I'm kind of saving for the very end, is that in over half our cases, The shared death experiencer sees the dying in the afterlife.
I find this really fascinating because in the end of life research study that we did, we looked a lot at the transpersonal experiences, but none of the carers or the relatives reported actually kind of accompanying the person. What they did talk about was a person seeing, we call them takeaways, dead relatives, or much loved dead relatives coming back to, and they had this sense that they were going to, the dead relatives were accompanying them or collecting them or waiting for them or helping them to die. We had a lot of stories about that, but we didn't have stories of the carer or the relative accompanying them as well into what happens next. So I'm very curious about that. And we spoke to a lot of people about this as well.
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, I think what you're referring to, Sue, you correct me, because, and just to be really clear, your research with Peter, that whole project was foundational, and our research sits on top of that. I mean, we're just building on it. So it's good we're having the conversation because, yeah, I think what you're referring to, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a lot of pre-death visions or visitations that the dying is either, it looks like they're conversing with deceased relatives or spirit beings. And sometimes they can say, you know, oh, I'm talking to my deceased partner or my mother, or sometimes just the caregivers who are at the bedside will notice that their dying loved one is having these conversations and they can tell who. So, but that happens typically before an actual death, an actual transition. But
so you know, are you talking about the actual, you know, the moment when somebody enters into the dying, that moment when it's they've tipped, you know that they're dying, you know, and the death happens really quickly when it's tipped, doesn't it? It happens in a within a minute. Are we talking about that?
Typically, yes. But once again, I want to go back to what Peter has said, Dr. Peter Fenwick said, and I really think he's got it, is that, you know, the medical perception of death is that it occurs when, you know, the brainwaves stop, heartbeat stops. But really what Peter says, it's really a longer period of time where he feels that the soul spirit is titrating back and forth between the human realm and this next dimension. And that we don't know how long that is, but I will just kind of say, you know, that can be minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour. I think depending on each person's disease process or dying process, whatever they're dying from, that has a part of it as well. But to answer your question specifically, 75% of our shared death experiencers report that they had the experience right at the time of death. And another 25%, like I think it's 9% or so, will say it was a few minutes, you know, maybe up to an hour before. And about 13-14% will say it happened a few minutes after, 20-30 minutes, maybe an hour, and a very few cases up to a day. So the death, knowing when that death actually happens is, and medically they've got a formula, but for, you know, the soul spirit, that's a bit different. But to be clear, we are talking about an observation, a witnessing, or an accompanying of a caregiver, loved one, or bystander of the dying person's transition, because we see movement. The key determinant in a shared death experience is the motif of journey. There's some sort of movement that's either experienced, witnessed, sensed, or observed. That's really important. And so, yes, I wanted to say one other thing about your research, which I think I know corresponds to what we found. Peter has talked about the deathbed coincidence.
Yes.
And I think that is what we would call, you know, maybe you, Sue, since this comes out of your research, would you mind defining that for your audience?
Well, the experience that we had in the research project was that at the moment of somebody's death, when somebody wasn't present, so it could have been, because it was often between grandparent and grandchild. So obviously the grandchild was not present at the deathbed, but the dead or well, the dying or the moment the person died, they would appear and sit on the bed, or suddenly the child would have a dream, but they would wake up at the moment. And in the morning, they knew that person had died. It also happens when couples are very, very close and one of the couples dies and the other couple's not there. And they have a sort of message, or they have a symbol, or they know that person's died. And of course, bingo, the phone rings. And of course, it's the hospital or a friend or the police or whatever it is saying this person has died. And it is correlates to that moment that this their partner or whoever it is knows they've died.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I'm glad you stated it the way you did, because our research has found these experiences as well. And there's a continuum of these experiences. So sometimes, you know, as your research pointed out, a digital clock will stop at just the time of death, and they'll wake up at that time. We're talking about the caregiver loved one. They look at the clock and they see 3:30, 4 a.m., whatever. And then they remember that. And the next morning, they get a call maybe a few hours later and they say, oh, your relative died at, you know, 3:34 a.m. So you have all those digital electrical things that share as deathbed coincidences. But then you have another continuum that you talked about that is often described as dreams. But our research has pushed into this with that term dreams. And as we listen to them talk, more often than not, it isn't a dream. If it happens at night, they'll use the term dream, because we associate any of these phenomena that occur in a sleep state as a dream. But, you know, as you know, as psychotherapists, Sue, we know that a dream is different than a vision or a visitation. So, like, let's use that example that comes out of your research about, and this is cited, that the woman who's in UK and she has a dream, she calls it a dream, where her son appears to her and he is all wet. And he comes to her and he says, Mom, I'm okay. I love you. And I'll see you again, or something like that. Just basically, and she wakes up and says, wow, I just had a dream of my son. He's in his 20s or so, and he's in Australia, but he was all wet. I don't quite understand that. He says he's okay. He sent me love. I know he's alive and well. And then she gets a call the next morning saying your son in Australia drowned. Mm-hmm. So when we push into that, what we find out is that actually, and I have not interviewed this woman, but in our experience, when we get a case like that, they present as, oh, I had this dream. My son appeared. He was wet. He drowned. I found it the next day. This makes sense. But if we go into more detail about that, she will end up likely telling us more things that she observed, where he was, what were some other messages, what was the other phenomena around her. And here's one. I don't know this is the case with this particular situation, but I do know in the dozens of cases we have that are similar to this, that often what they'll say is, oh yeah, he appeared. He said, thank you. I love you. Goodbye. And then he just moved away and he was off moving. And that tells us that he's on a journey, he's visiting, and that he's moving away. And she can oftentimes tell us what she saw. She'll often say, oh, moving towards the light. So once again, I think your research is so foundational. And we got really curious about all these experiences, but the SDE was the one that tends to be most profound. And we got a lot of these cases. And then now, you know, now with the research, we have hundreds. I mean, now I think we've over 250 cases deeply studied, another 200 that we're going to be studying this winter.
I think the value of this study is normalizing it. And I think that's incredibly important, because people still think they're crazy when they talk about, or they kind of keep it to themselves because they're so frightened that people are going to think that they're crazy. And I love the normalizing of inverted commas strange things that happen when people die. I just wanted to ask you, why did you get into this work? What drew you to this work in the first place?
A great question. You know, I had a near-death experience at 17 years old, just a high-speed skiing accident, catapulted out of my body, sailed through a beautiful universe, went to the light, and I grew up Catholic. So I talked to God. I said, you know, hey, I don't want to die. I don't think I finished what I came here to do. And, you know, there was this beautiful interaction where God kind of telepathically said, you know, make something in your life. And then I felt this push back to my human life, which I did. I came back, but I was deeply injured. I fractured my spine and had really suffered a great deal with chronic pain and what have you. But that experience I didn't talk about, even though it happened in 1979 in Raymond Moody's book on the near-death experience. This is a classic near-death experience, was out, but that wasn't in my culture, you know. So I would have another near-death experience, and then I was just out of body with a blood imbalance in a hospital in the ICU, and I was hovering above my body in the ICU, looking at my body, listening to people talk. And at that point, I realized, you know, I'm not my body at all. Whatever I call myself is not that human body, because I had a consciousness that was fully engaged outside of it. This got me interested in death and dying and some deaths in my family, where these, what we talked about earlier, my grandmother had a lot of pre-death visions where she was talking to relatives and I was listening to nurses and, you know, healthcare providers saying, oh, she's just hallucinating. I'm going, I don't think so. I know my grandmother, she's having a conversation here. And this feels as if this old friend of hers is in the room. So I went into hospice. And when I went into hospice work out of this curiosity, and I worked with the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco, you know, now around the turn of the century, 2000, 2002. And I started observing all these other phenomena, these pre-death visions, but I started having shared death experiences with my patients. I would be at the bedside and all of a sudden I would be out of my body and I'd be with them. And we'd have a conversation outside with me. I can remember one, just me above my body. And this client name change, Ron, was also above his body. And he was telling me, hey, this is where I am right now. You know, I'm spending a lot of time up here. And isn't this great? Well, I didn't have any lexicon, any understanding for this experience, except that I did not doubt it, because I'd had the two previous near-death experiences. I said, wait a minute. I've had this before. I'm healthy in mind and body. This is something. As it turned out at Zen Hospice, you know, my supervisor, which I love, he was just kind of dismissive of it. So I didn't talk about him, but I'd have many more of these experiences while I was working at Zen Hospice Project. I still didn't really talk about it very much, because for the reasons you were brought up quite sagely, you can't talk about this in a medical setting. They're going to think you're having hallucinations at best, delusions, what have you, grief hallucinations, or just worse than that, going crazy, having a manic episode. So I learned, as everyone else does, hey, it's not safe to share these experiences. Then Raymond Moody started doing his research, wrote his book, Glimpses of Eternity, in 2009. I met Raymond and we became fast friends. And I said, I know about this. I want to help people have this. And I want to do exactly what you said, Sue. I want to normalize this, because this is a spectacular experience that everybody needs to know about. It is such a gift for people to know that your loved ones are alive and well, and you're going to be reunited with them later.
I'm still struggling with the whole concept of what happens after death. And I'll explain why and just see what your take on it is. I struggle with the fact that I really respect and I feel very inspired by the Buddhist belief that talks about that consciousness exists after death. The ego dies, but consciousness becomes sort of enters the zeitgeist or whatever it is as a stream that continues. We don't know where or don't know how it happens, but it continues as a stream, and then it reincarnates in a different ego, in a different personality, in a different body, with a different destiny, and obviously with a different focus on spiritual growth. So that's one way of looking at what happens after death. And the other one, which you say, and I get it, it's a kind of more spiritualist belief that we continue as we are after death, complete with our ego and our personality. And I really struggle. I find this baffling, and I struggle to reconcile the two belief systems. And I just wondered what your take was about all of that.
I love the struggle. I share it with you. You know, I have a Buddhist practice. I mean, I started doing this Buddhist practice And in the 90s, with my chronic pain from my back injury, that's how I got into the Zen hospice work, because they had a very Buddhist way of looking at death and dying, which is be present, be compassionate, you know, and just see what's happening. You don't add anything. You don't try to take the dying person's pain away. You really bring loving presence and tolerate and work with what comes out with you. And yes, the way you described the Buddhist understanding or teachings on, you know, transmigration or reincarnation, however you know, those are different terms for it. It's similar to what I understand. But I found that the Buddhist interpretation was missing a little bit, in the sense that I found that, and I should say I'm a past life regressionist and a between life regressionist as well. So I work with my clients in grief and bereavement, and we'll go into that space in the previous lives and their transitions and things. And while I do think the ego and the personality, the ego lessens, but some of the personality traits continue. I think that's karma. I actually think that's karma. I think karmically what survives between lives is some of our egoic points. Yes, a lot of that kind of human ego drops, but some of our personality traits are karmically attached to us. That's kind of what we work on life after life. So I kind of believe with the Buddhist idea of transmigration, multiple lives, because I've seen it in my work with past life regression therapy. I've seen, you know, people come up with stories you cannot make up. They corroborate them. They see their other relatives there. And I've seen my own past lives in my own meditations. So Buddhist meditation. So I'm all there with that. But what I do see in these meditations is I do see a sense of self. And when I say self, a sense of character, a sense of personality, a sense of me that often is not pleasant at all. Often it's deeply flawed. And I say that in a loving way. And I think that's why I continue to reincarnate, as I'm trying to work down that we might want to call these egoic parts of ourselves. So I see both of them. I would say there's more of a self, an enduring self, than the Buddhists want to give credence to. But I think both of them are very helpful. And at the end of the day, I want to be perfectly clear. By no means do I plant my pole on anything. I could see all of this, all of my thoughts and experiences, as being subjected to and diminished by a greater reality that I have not touched into yet. And I'm sure that is the case, that there is a greater reality that would dwarf any of my functional theories that I have in the human realm to help people around their own pain and suffering. That's why I think these theories are helpful, is that it gives people a rational research base for believing that, in some cases, knowing that we somehow survive and that our relationships do endure beyond human death. And that's very healing. And I think I say this from a point of research. This is what we've learned. And I'm not stretching it just to make people feel good. I think this is what the research delivers.
I want to talk to you about, you talk a lot on your website, and also you have earlier on in this podcast, you describe relatives or carers as loved ones. And I think that's absolutely wonderful when they are. But in my experience, so many people have terribly traumatic relationships with close relatives, and these people are not loved ones. They may have been incredibly abusive, or, you know, fractured relationships, or they didn't love their mother or the father, or they couldn't, or whatever the loved one does not exist in that relationship. And so what happens when somebody isn't a loved one? Can you still have a shared crossing with them, do you think?
So there's a couple of different ways to look at this. One is, let's say a daughter is at the bedside of a dying mother and they didn't have a good relationship. She's there. This is an actual case of an old client case a decade ago. And I remember her coming to me saying, I don't like my mother. I'm estranged from her. I've talked to her maybe 2 times in 5 years. And I said to her, I think you should consider just showing up for your mother, just to support her And I actually said to her, I think you're going to get something out of this because you can do it as service, if nothing else. There's no one there for your mother. She lived a difficult life. Anyway, long story short, she had this experience where she had a past life review where she saw her mother's life, reviewed her, and she saw that her mother was deeply abused and assaulted and had some terrible relationships that she never shared with her daughter. And her daughter came into the next session and was, you know, she shared this experience and she was weeping. And she says, for as brutal of a mother as she was to me, as abusive she was not nearly as abusive as the abuse that I saw her in these past life and this review and the life review that I saw. And my mother was not showing this to me for any other. I don't think my mother was showing it to me. I think there was some source that was revealing this to me, but she was, I couldn't have made this stuff up. I mean, like after this, I feel I'm healed with my mother in a certain way. I mean, I feel like I understand. And not that, you know, there's not the loss and grief, but point being is these experiences can be very healing. Then again, to be clear, let's just say you're the one dying and you have a relative on the other side who was abusive to you or harmed you deeply. That can create dissonance and difficulty in the transition. And I've seen this, I'm sure you have too, Sue, that your unfinished business, if you feel like there's an abusive father waiting for you at the threshold, man, that's going to create a lot of anxiety and stress. It's going to make your passing a lot more difficult. We have had shared death experiencers. I'll give an example just about that. A mother was dying. Her father had sexually abused her. The daughter and her brother, this is son, daughter, and a sister-in-law, all at the bedside, and the mother passed, and the shared death experiencers saw the father come into view who had abused their mother. Their grandfather, the father of the mother comes into view, and what they see is a deeply apologetic, a deeply humbled, a cautious, honoring father who's making safety for their mother, his daughter who he abused as she passes. So what I'm giving these examples because I believe the shared death experience offers healing, deeper insight. I think that the human traumas that we have, which are real and painful, I think the shared death experience offers us an opportunity for healing. I can't say that in every case. I can say that sometimes you're anticipating or fearful of a harmful family relative or anybody to appear, and they don't appear. I mean, the shared death experiencers will say more times than not, I didn't see that person. I know my mother was afraid of it. I didn't see that person at all, but there was a greeting party.
So. I think it's really important to make it clear that not everybody has these experiences, and it's okay if you don't have the experiences.
Yeah.
A lot of people do, and it's lovely to normalize them, but not to feel that you're less than or the death of the person has suffered because you haven't had a shared crossing. William, I just want to finish off by just asking you about the workshops and the training programs that you run. Can you explain what people will learn when they sign up? And yeah. I know they can just get in touch with you via your sharedcrossingproject.com website, but just to tell people what you offer.
Thank you. So we offer a number of workshops and trainings and seminars. Our flagship program is called the Shared Crossing Pathway Seminar. And what it does is it prepares people for what we call a conscious, connected, and loving end-of-life experience. And we teach the methods that enable the shared death experience and other shared crossings. So, you know, how effective are these methods? We haven't done the research on this to really, we will be doing it, but to really get a number that would say this is backed by the research. Anecdotally, I can say conservatively between 25 and 50% of the people that take our pathway program will have a shared death experience when a loved one is dying. I can tell you this, upwards of 90% will have some type of shared crossing. That means they'll have a pre-death vision that you already talked about, Sue, that we talked about, or a post-death shared crossing, which is a visitation or a vision. It's some sort of after-death communication. So people are really pleased, that's what our feedback is, that they have these types of experiences because they feel like while their human relationship has come to an end, they still have a meaningful relationship with their loved one in the spirit realm. So that's one thing. That's our main course. Yeah, Sue, did you have something else?
Yeah. Thank you. That's absolutely brilliant. Do you do another course as well?
Yeah, thank you. We have other courses and seminars that just check our website after them. We do seasonal updates where we talk about, like, there's going to be one on shared death experience and pets, which is actually a thing. You should know about that.
Yeah, for
everyone
sure.
Loves their pets. Yeah, it's a good one. And then we have different spirit beings, the conductor, like a shared death experiences and how the conductor appears, who helps us cross over. But I'm also doing a course with the Shift Network, which many of you may know the Shift Network. And this is really a teaching about what is a shared death experience. And then I'll be interviewing some of our really wonderful research participants, and they will talk about their experiences. And I will tease apart and talk about what it is, what are the features that make the shared death experience so meaningful? And then we'll talk about the transformational value. If I were to say one final comment about the SDE, is the transformational value of the SDE is phenomenal. It relieves death anxiety. It gives us a sense that we go into a benevolent afterlife, that we'll be reunited with our loved ones. And it gives us this amazing intuitive capacity to be more open, more receptive, more, excuse the term, kind of psychically connected with other people and other realms. And I think that's delivered in the energetic power of the SDE, similar to the near-death experience. So yeah, there you have it.
Well, thank you so much, William. I've loved talking to you. It just reminds me about how precious this research is and how it helps everybody. So I'm so grateful to you. That was William Peters, founder of the Shared Crossing Project. And as we've been talking about, you can find out more about his work through his website, sharedcrossingproject.com. Now, my March guest is called Gabby, whose very active life completely changed when she was age 23 because a suitcase fell on her head. And it might sound funny, but for her, it turned into a completely life-changing experience, because since then she's lived with constant neurological pain. And she's really had to grapple over the years with massive questions about the meaning of life. Especially now, her physical abilities have seriously curtailed how she can engage with life. I think you're going to find her story very moving, and I'm in awe of her courage for facing the consequences of such a life-changing experience and what it's done to her since this happened. So I'm going to see you then on March the 1st with my guest, Gabby. And again, thanks to William Peters from Shared Crossing Project. See you then. Bye for now.